Welcome back, everybody. I assume you feel like I do that it wasn't long enough. So we left off with interrogation in wrapping up the Miranda materials. So let's see if we can get through everything, which I think we can. So, police arrest a defendant for a shotgun murder. They put him in the back of a police car, give Miranda warnings, and he says he wants a lawyer. One of the police officers, after that, they stop questioning him, but one of the officers then turns to him and says, that shotgun of yours is somewhere around here, and there's a nearby school for handicapped children. One of those kids could pick up the gun and kill herself. Where did you hide the gun? The defendant says, okay, I'll lead you to the gun. Can the shotgun and testimony regarding finding it be admitted at the defendant's subsequent murder trial? This is not Innes. It's a riff on Innes. So what's the answer to this question? Joseph?
The answer is they can use the testimony because he was given his Miranda warnings but waived his rights by choosing to speak anyway.
By what?
Choosing to speak anyway. When he was given his Miranda warnings of being allowed to...
He invoked his right to counsel. In this hypothetical, he invoked his right to counsel.
Okay.
Does that change your answer?
No. No, if I remember correctly.
This isn't the case.
Yeah.
This is a deviation from the case with a purpose.
I'm going to say I don't know. I'll go to counsel for that.
I think so.
Elvira?
I think it changes the situation.
How so?
Well, since he wanted the lawyer present, I mean, by invoking his right, I think anything he says after that is not admissible.
Okay. If there's what? What?
An attorney present?
No. Everything after that is inadmissible if there's what? Coercion?
No, I said that. He didn't say that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you did, Hussein.
Is it custodial interrogation?
Yeah. And what's the point of this question? What section are we in? Interrogation.
Yeah.
So, was there custody? Yes.
Yeah.
He invoked his right to counsel. I'm sorry, yeah, he invoked his right to counsel, so all questioning must cease until counsel is present. What happened then? The officer asked him a question. Therefore, the officer violated Miranda. Now, why did I put this in here? What's the difference between hypo 1 and hypo 2? Hypo 2 is same except while the defendant is in the back of the police car, one officer says to the other the same thing that was put to the defendant as a question in hypo 1. So this is Innes. Does the answer change? Remember, hypo 1, there was a question and it violated Miranda. Here's hypo 2. What's different about it? Saying?
It's not a question directed at the person in custody, but I think Ennis said if the officer's note is likely to get the person in custody to give incriminating statements, then it
could sort of.
Never mind.
What?
That's what I read in Ennis, but
Well, but you're paraphrasing it.
Yeah, I don't know the exact rule, but it was something
okay,
about...
Okay, it might be behoove you to try and use the exact language. So, basically, what did Innes define interrogation as? Two parts to it. Either direct questioning or the functional equivalent, which is conduct, words of conduct, that the officers know or should know is likely to evoke an incriminating response. I'm paraphrasing, but not as much as you did, I'm saying. So the question then is what happened here the functional equivalent of direct questioning? And the court held, no. So do you buy that? No, it's hard to swallow, isn't it? I mean, even the language that is quoted, oh golly gee, you know. But let's examine the functional equivalent. So here I have same as hypo 2, except the police officer has read in a police training manual, and I say, I reference Inbow and Reed, about the ploy he uses to appeal to the defendant's concern for a child. Okay. Why am I referring to a police manual?
Because the case discussed police manual tactics for interrogation.
What case?
It was the next one.
No, it was Miranda. Miranda goes on and on about that and cites, among other police manuals, Inbow and Reed. So I have an ulterior motive to cite this. When I was in law school, my criminal law professor was Fred Inbow, the co-author of this manual. He also was the founder, along with some other people, of the first scientific crime detection lab, which was part of the Chicago Police Department. So he actually worked for the Chicago Police Department in his early years in his career. He then became a law professor at Northwestern. He was very renowned. And when I took him, which was in the early 1960s, he was known as Freddy the Cop. Now remember, this is the 1960s. So most of the students in law school were rather liberal, to put it mildly. And so most of the students really didn't care much for Freddy the Cop because he was always on the cop side. And so he was very self-conscious about that and frankly felt quite intimidated by the attitude of the people in class. But he was a great teacher, and I learned a lot from him. So I graduated from law school, and I went to Washington, D.C. I was in the Prettyman program at Georgetown. I was there for 3 years, and then went to a law firm in D.C. And then I got an offer to come to teach. So in 1968, I was packing up our house in Reston, Virginia. Reston, Virginia is a new town outside of Washington, and it was really new then. There were very few residents. And one of the attributes of Reston was that it was developed around a town center. So the housing emanated out from it as it was growing. So I got in the car one morning to go to the supermarket. There was a supermarket in the town center to get boxes to pack up. I had my infant son with me. He was 4 years old at the time. And I go into the grocery store and come out with some boxes. And as I'm putting them in the trunk of the car, I hear this voice yell, "Stop that man!" And I turn around and I see this woman coming out of the bank. There was a branch of a bank there. And I knew her because I played bridge with her. So I don't know what the hell is going on. And at that moment, this very strange looking little guy comes walking fast past my car and starts to get into a car right next to me. In the car were two young children and an elderly woman. So she screams, the teller screams again, "Stop that man!" So I run over to the car, and he's now getting into the car and about to put the key in the ignition. I put my hands on the door, the window was down, and I stuck my head in and I say, "Stop!" He stops. I say, "Get out of the car!" He gets out of the car. At that moment, she arrives, the bank teller, and she starts screaming, "Oh my God, he actually has them!" Well, it turned out he had conned the babysitter, an elderly woman, into coming with him to the bank. And he went into the bank and he handed a note to the teller. "I have," and he named the children and Mrs. whatever her name was, "and if you give me all your money, they'll be safe." And she looks at him and gasps and she says, "I don't have any money. We just opened up. This is a branch. We get our delivery of funds in about 15 minutes. And by the way, the note was signed, "Your friendly bank robber." So he says, "Okay, I'll come back another time." And he leaves. And that's when the scene starts that I had started out with. At that moment, I mean, she's carrying on. And I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. I didn't really know what was going on. At that moment, some law enforcement officers arrive and they take him into custody, and it turned out that all of this came out, and he was carted off. So he was charged with a federal offense of attempted bank robbery, for which he got 10 years, I later learned. And it turned out he was a demented rabbi from Newport Beach, Virginia, where he worked at a children's facility for adopted children, for orphan children. And his explanation was he was trying to get funds to assist the institution. So he gets carted off. I become a local hero. My name was in the paper, the front page of the Washington Post the next day. And this was almost at the time I was leaving. So when I left, I got back to Chicago. I had the clippings from the newspaper. And by the time I got to school to start, I was carrying that with me. I walk into the law school. I go to Fred Imbau's office, and I walk in, and I put down this. Oh, and I got a letter from J. Edgar Hoover congratulating me. So I walk into Fred's office, and I put down the newspaper clipping and the letter from J. Edgar Hoover, and I said, "Look at that." He looks at it, he says, "Well, you finally learned something." So I am particularly enamored of the ability to refer to Fred Imbau as being the source of the Miranda rule, which he was in large part responsible for it. The court refers to those manuals to describe the techniques that abound that caused the court to adopt Miranda. So here, if he looks at it, if the police officer can be shown to have had this training and have used a particular manual recommending this ploy, what does that do for the Innis test? Joseph?
So the Innis test, again, interrogation is direct questioning or the functional equivalent conduct where the police either knew or should have known that such conduct would elicit a response.
Yeah.
And so when you use a tactic from the manual, the police know that tactic is going to act as a functional equivalent.
Yeah.
And so therefore they're interrogating, and that's...
It's the functional equivalent, and Innis is satisfied. I agree. So the result would come out different. Okay, next hypothetical. Defendant has been indicted and arrested for a kidnapping murder of a young girl. While he is being transported in a police car to his arraignment, and while an area-wide search is ongoing to find the girl's body, a police officer makes a Christian burial speech to the defendant. And the defendant knows, I mean, the police officer knows that the defendant is insanely religious. He's a suspected abductor and murderer, but he's very religious. So the Christian burial speech could be said to have been designed to appeal to his incredible devotion to religion. The defendant stops them and leads the police to the girl's body. Can the testimony about the discovery of the body be admitted at the defendant's subsequent trial for kidnapping and murder? So this is roughly the facts of Brewer versus Williams. Brewer versus Williams is in the next chapter down the road, one of the next ones, and the court cites it and discusses it in Innis in order to contrast the differing outcomes between Innis and Brewer versus Williams. So what is the difference between the test applicable in Brewer versus Williams versus the test applicable in Innis involving Miranda interrogation? Anybody know? No. Well, look at footnote 4 in Innis, page 837. There's language in the opinion of the Rhode Island Supreme Court in this case suggesting that the definition of interrogation under Miranda is informed by this court's decision in Brewer versus Williams. This suggestion is erroneous. The test, the footnote goes on to explain, the test for Sixth Amendment right to counsel, which is Brewer versus Williams, is deliberate elicitation, which we have to look at in order to distinguish from the definition of interrogation in Innis. So first thing is, what is the right that was the subject matter of Brewer versus Williams? A very important aspect of that case, in contrast to Innis, is that in Brewer, the defendant Williams was indicted and counsel was appointed for him. Actually, he had two counsel. He was arrested in Iowa in one city, and he had to go to court in another city a couple of hundred miles away. So he was being transported from city to city And the police put him in a police car to transport him, and they didn't allow his lawyer to join them. So the lawyer said to the defendant, Williams, don't say anything at all until you get to your destination and your other lawyer is present. And that's in the interim between that and the statement that he made was the Christian burial speech. So the test in Brewer versus Williams was whether it could be said that an agent of the government deliberately elicited the statement from the suspect or the defendant without counsel being present when the right to counsel was invoked and attached. And so the court goes on and says the right in Brewer, as we had held in Messiah, prohibits law enforcement officers from deliberately eliciting incriminating information from a defendant in the absence of counsel after a formal charge against the defendant has been filed. Custody in such a case is not controlling. By contrast, the right to counsel at issue in the present case is based not on the 6th and 14th Amendments, but rather on the 5th and 14th Amendments. Therefore, Miranda governs, and the definition of interrogation under the 5th and 6th Amendments, if indeed the term interrogation is even apt in the 6th Amendment context, are not necessarily interchangeable, since the policies underlying the two constitutional protections are quite distinct. So, what is the policy behind the 6th Amendment right to counsel? It is that a defendant who was once a suspect and now has been formally charged has turned into a defendant. The relationship of the government to the suspect defendant has completely changed. It has gone from investigatory to adversarial. When that happens, the defendant has a right to counsel that is very different from the right that could be obtained by invoking Fifth Amendment right to counsel under Miranda. Okay? So, what's deliberate elicitation? Well, the focus of deliberate elicitation is what was the intent of the law enforcement officers or the agent of government. The test for interrogation or the functional equivalent, as the court describes in the text accompanying footnote 7 and in footnote 7 itself. Remember, the language that footnote 7 supports is a practice that the police should know is reasonably likely to evoke an incriminating response from a suspect, thus amounts to interrogation. Footnote 7, that is not to say that the intent of the police is irrelevant, for it may have a bearing on whether the police should have known that what they were doing or saying was likely to evoke an incriminating response. But look at the first line of that footnote, first language, the first clauses. That is not to say the intent of the police is irrelevant, which suggests that the intent of the police is, if not irrelevant, vastly diminished when deciding whether there was interrogation, because it is the effect upon the suspect that is the focus of the inquiry. In particular, where police practice is designed to elicit an incriminating response from the accused, it is likely that the practice will not also not be one which the police should have known was reasonably likely to have that effect. So it's a bit complicated, a bit complex, but that's a mini course in it right there. Anybody have any questions?
No.
Well, I think that if you have issues with this, it would behoove you to go over this part of the PowerPoint and the language in us itself. So here's the detail in the PowerPoint of Innis. Again, the question is, what constitutes interrogation within the meaning of Miranda? The court held that the officer's conversation did not amount to interrogation, but also recognized that Miranda should not be narrowly limited to express questioning. So here's what I've discovered in exams and students' approach to these issues in exams. And by the way, I'm in the process of writing your essay exam. I'm about halfway through it. And I will discuss more about it as we come to the end. But you can almost bet that there will be a police interrogation situation, either under the Fifth Amendment Miranda or Sixth Amendment right to counsel, or both. So here's what I want to comment on. You're addressing a question on the exam that evokes concern by you that maybe Miranda applies, and you have to decide, was there custody and interrogation for starters? And so the fact pattern presents, let's say, a cutting edge issue a la Innis, which presents for you the need to analyze whether what happened constituted interrogation. Here's my point. If there is a direct question, that's the answer. And my experience is that students, more than half the time, don't recognize that. If there's direct questioning, you've got your answer. There's interrogation under the test of Innis for Miranda. If it isn't direct questioning, which would make it a more cutting edge scenario, then you have to decide whether the complex components of the functional equivalent test have been met to constitute interrogation or not, which would constitute no interrogation. Okay? Everybody got it? Shiva? Okay, I'll be on the lookout for your test. Lucky for you, your exams are anonymous. And I. What?
Lucky for you, there's only 6 degrees.
Are you kidding? I know how lucky I am. I'm not happy with teaching this class with so small an enrollment, except for the grading. Okay, police practices invoking the concern of Miranda include several that do not involve express questioning, but involve rather subtle psychological ploys. Interrogation, as defined by the court, includes the functional equivalent of express questioning. And here's the operative language. Words or actions that the police should know are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. And what's potentially very confusing about this is the test for Sixth Amendment right to counsel under Brewer versus Williams and Messiah, a case that preceded Brewer versus Williams by many years, is deliberate elicitation. So elicitation or elicit is a word that appears in both definitions. But the big distinction is this aspect of whether we look at the conduct and utterances from the police's point of view or the effect upon the defendant suspect. For Miranda, the effect upon the suspect is the primary concern, a la first line of footnote 7. For Sixth Amendment right to counsel under Messiah Williams, it is the focus upon what the police officer did and said, because if it's deliberate elicitation, then the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is violated. Okay. The court concluded that the officer's conversation about the school children was nothing more than a dialogue and did not invite a response from defendant. If you're troubled by the outcome of Innes, from the point of view of whether there was a purpose to elicit an incriminating response by the conversation between the police officers with the defendant knowingly in the back, and maybe one of the officers was sitting next to him, as the dissent points out, I've always looked at this case from this point of view. How likely is it that a trier of fact, which would be the trial court, would find that the police in Innes knew or should have known that what they were saying would elicit an incriminating response? It ain't very likely. Even if their purpose was to hope that the defendant would respond to their conversation and incriminate himself, or help them find the body, which was the shotgun, which was the purpose. Think about it. They have this hardened killer, and would a reasonable police officer think that this conversation would get through to this guy? In the absence of any knowledge of him having a soft spot for children or handicapped children, not likely. So I'm comfortable with the result in Innes because of that thought on my part. Okay, what's the meaning of the court's test? Reasonably likely means that the test focuses on the probability that a particular police conduct will be successful. And maybe the focus is on whether a person in the suspect's position would perceive the police conduct as designed to elicit an incriminating response. And the court said the focus is primarily upon the perception of the suspect rather than the intent of the police. But we're revisiting this, obviously. Footnote 7 points out the intent of the police is not irrelevant. Was the result, the court's result, correct? The language used by the police officers, including God forbid and gee, that would be too bad, does not seem to be the type that police officers would use in normal conversation, but does seem calculated to evoke a response from a suspect. And I think that that's fair. On the other hand, a suspect might think the police were expressing their genuine concern and not trying to elicit a response. So we have a few hypotheticals to raise the question whether this would amount to interrogation within the meaning of the court's test. First, I wonder why someone would shoot a taxi driver with a shotgun, and put a question mark at the end to satisfy the dissenter. The victim was scum. I'd like to shake hands with whoever killed him. That's one of the ploys suggested in the Inbow and Reed manual or some others, because it's a trick. I'd like to shake the hand of whoever killed that scumbag. And the defendant responds to an outstretched hand by reaching to shake, which is an admission of he's the one who shot him. What are you, you're laughing?
Sorry, that's just such a dumb response. Okay.
Such a what?
Dumb response on the guy's part, just sitting well, in the car and like.
We're coming.
I get it's like a tactic that's meant to cause things like that, but to think that actually works is just really funny.
There's an element of how could this possibly work for many of those ploys. But think about the case that we're coming to. I can't believe the name of it escapes me at the moment. I can't believe that. Hold on a minute. Burgess versus Tompkins in the next section. So the police are interrogating this guy. He hasn't invoked his right to counsel or silence. 2 hours and 45 minutes go by, and one of the officers says, "Do you believe in God?" Direct question. "Yes." "Do you pray for forgiveness for killing that guy?" That's the same thing. And the defendant says, "Yes, I do pray for that." And that's the admission that was used against him to get the conviction that the Supreme Court approved, because he didn't invoke his right to silence. Therefore, questioning was permitted. So, that's no less funny than the other one. "If we don't find a gun that and a poor child gets hurt, the person who hit it may face another charge." So all of those are certainly worthy of consideration, those hypotheticals. Once again, how did the court define the functional equivalent of express questioning? Again, a review of the test summarized for you. Concluding Innis, summary of Miranda interrogation: express questioning or words or conduct by police that the police should know are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. Contrasted with the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, law enforcement officers are prohibited from deliberately eliciting incriminating information from a defendant in the absence of counsel after a formal charge against the defendant has been filed. So, again, remember the Sixth Amendment right to counsel does not apply. It isn't triggered unless and until there are formal charges. And we'll explore the nuance of the definitions of that when we come to that section of the casebook. The next case is Illinois versus Perkins. Why was it that in Perkins, the Supreme Court held that the government putting an undercover agent, no doubt it was a law enforcement agent, in the same cell block with the defendant to try and find out if they could get information against the defendant? Why wasn't that? And there was direct questioning. You read the description of what went on between the defendant and the other undercover agent. Clearly, there was questioning. The defendant was in custody. He was incarcerated, awaiting formal charges. So the Sixth Amendment right to counsel had not been triggered. Why was it that the court found there was no violation of Miranda under those circumstances? The answer is short and succinct. Christian?
I don't recall.
What?
I don't recall the answer.
Mika?
Can you repeat the question?
Why did the court find that there was no violation of Miranda by an undercover agent questioning an incarcerated suspect?
He doesn't have any rights anymore.
Can't hear you.
Because since he's incarcerated, he doesn't have the
rights. I still can't hear you.
Because he's incarcerated, he doesn't have the rights.
Why would someone incarcerated not have the right? If there's custody and interrogation, one would think that Miranda would be satisfied. Clearly, a person who's incarcerated is in custody. Vera?
I'm reading online right now. That's
you're what?
I'm reading it online.
Hussein?
Go ahead.
The Fifth Amendment privilege versus self-incrimination is not implicated when a suspect is not aware they're speaking to the law enforcement.
Why? Why would that be so?
Undercover so he doesn't know?
What is the concern of the courts with Miranda interrogation?
Oh, the coercion factor?
Presumption of coercion from what? Police-dominated atmosphere. So there's no scenario that's close to a police-dominated atmosphere if the suspect doesn't know he's talking to the police. It's just that simple. So that's it in a nutshell. Okay. There is a thread of an interesting point in Justice Marshall's dissent suggesting that the defendant in this case might have felt pressured to respond that he had done someone in order to earn the respect of the undercover agent and thus be accepted as part of the escape attempt. That's a fairly sophisticated twist in terms of analysis, a good idea from Justice Marshall, but he didn't garner other votes. What about a due process violation? What is necessary for there to be a due process violation? Hello? What is necessary for there to be a due process violation? This is really simple.
If there was coercion.
Yeah.
So like the dissent talks about the possibility of this of the undercover agent actually like beating the guy or just being more aggressive with getting coercion.
Right. So if the court's analysis denying questioning custodial questioning for purposes of Miranda, if that's accepted, then how could one say, since there's no coercive atmosphere, that there was coercion to satisfy due process? So a majority of the court wouldn't buy into that either. In what situations will a prison informer's questioning of another inmate exert coercive pressure? Well, Fulminante is a good reference point. I don't know if you remember, but in the video that we watched the first day of class, there was more than one reference to the Fulminante decision. But I say here, that case demonstrates that determining when and under what circumstances such coercion takes place will obviously be difficult. Justice White's majority for the opinion for the majority concluded The lower court finding that the defendant's will was overborne was supportable because he faced a credible threat of physical violence. And Justice Rehnquist's dissent noted that the defendant offered no evidence that he believed his life was in danger. What happened there was that there was evidence that the elicitation of the information that led to the conviction of the defendant was obtained by an offer of protection against the white supremacist other inmates. And so a strong argument was made that the defendant was seeking protection, and that's why he gave it up. But that only garnered a dissenting point of view. Why did Miranda adopt a presumption of coercion in the absence of proof of actual coercion for due process purposes? Remember, in part because of the difficulty in determining the precise nature of the pressure exerted by the police on a suspect subject to custodial interrogation at the station house. Cases such as Fulminante indicate that a similar presumption of coercion may be appropriate when a prison informer is seeking to obtain information from a fellow inmate. So that is sort of a revisitation of the actual coercion question relating to due process applied to a scenario such as occurred in both Perkins and Fulminante. So that's all we have for interrogation. Anybody have any comments or questions? I take it by your silence that the answer is no. But yet there's more. You guys just don't get my humor. See, that's why such a small class presents a problem for me. In a larger class, there would likely be at least one or two people who would get my humor, rather than you stone-faced audience. Okay. This is a PowerPoint on warnings and waiver. So there's two parts to what we're looking at in this subchapter. One, when there is some deviation from the exact language of the warnings as articulated by the court in Miranda, when there's a deviation from that language, does that negate the satisfaction of Miranda's requirements? And generally speaking, these cases demonstrate that when the police stop reading from their card, which takes the actual language from Miranda, they may engender some serious question as to whether they communicated the warnings properly. But it also demonstrates, these cases, that it takes a substantial deviation, not just some minuscule deviation or failure. So those are those cases. And waiver, in Miranda itself, the Supreme Court in the case said, and the language is very clear, that the government has a heavy burden to show that the suspect waived his rights. The cases don't bear that out. Miranda has been undone in terms of the heavy burden language. And in the context of that language, the court in Miranda also said, just showing the giving of warnings followed by silence and ultimately a statement isn't enough. It doesn't satisfy the heavy burden. But then in the Burgess case, the court holds otherwise. So, the defendant, a minor, was in custody on a murder charge. Police officers gave him Miranda warnings and he declined to talk. But when his parents arrived and conferred with him, he changed his mind. New warnings were given, in which the officer, in answer to the mother's question, said that the defendant would have an attorney when he went to court, and he could have one at this time if he wished. The defendant then made incriminating statements. This case goes all the way to the Supreme Court on the question of whether those warnings sufficiently communicated the idea that the defendant was entitled to have a lawyer with him during questioning. That was the argument, that it wasn't clear from this warning, because the language wasn't exact. This is the Prysock case. Court held the warnings were sufficient to convey the requirements of Miranda. Variations from the exact Miranda language are okay as long as the rights are fully conveyed. Second one. This is Duckworth versus Egan. The difference here was police officer read Miranda warnings from a card in use in Indiana, telling the defendant of his right, but noting that an attorney could be provided only if and when he went to court. So saying that you're entitled to an attorney during questioning and then turning around and saying you can't get an attorney unless and until you go to court is a rather confusing warning. So the argument was made that the defendant couldn't possibly have known that he could have not said anything because a lawyer wasn't present. Court rejected that as well. These warnings were okay since they accurately described Indiana's procedure and adequately conveyed the rights required by Miranda. So it would have been a simple matter for the warnings in Indiana to have a separate notification to the defendant that although he couldn't get a lawyer until he went to court, he didn't have to answer any questions without a lawyer being present. So that was the argument. The court rejected it, saying that the warnings that were read to him sufficiently informed him that he did have a right to have an attorney present. So the short of it is, in Indiana at the time, the police either questioned without an attorney, if no one invoked the right to remain silent or have an attorney, or if they did invoke, then they couldn't ask questions. Here's another one. Florida versus Powell. The warning said the defendant had the right to talk to a lawyer before answering any of the police officer's questions, but also had a catch-all provision. You have the right to use any of these rights at any time you want during this interview. The argument was that it was a confusing warning because it carried with it the idea that the defendant would have to if he would, if the police were questioning him alone without his lawyer present, he would have to ask to stop and then confer with the lawyer. It wasn't clear that the lawyer could be present during the questioning. There are two. Court held in combination, the two warnings reasonably conveyed the right to have an attorney present, not only at the outset of interrogation, but at all times. Here's another one. This is this is Burgess versus Tompkins. I've already described that. 2 hours and 45 minutes remaining essentially silent, but giving some yes or no answers during that time period. And then, do you believe in God? And pray that God will forgive you for shooting the victim. Second requirement for compliance with Miranda, a prerequisite for the admissibility of statements produced by custodial interrogation, is waiver of the rights to silence and counsel. Okay, and here's the reference to the language in Miranda itself. In the opening paragraph of his opinion, Chief Justice Warren stated, a defendant may waive these rights provided the waiver is made voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently. Later in the opinion, he returned to the subject, indicating, among other things, that if custodial interrogation proceeds without counsel present and a suspect confesses, a heavy burden rests on the government to demonstrate that the defendant knowingly and intelligently waived his privilege against self-incrimination and his right to retain an appointed counsel. Those opening statements and the requirements stated captures the three components of a valid waiver. There must be a waiver, evidence of a choice to relinquish one's rights. The choice to forego one's rights must be voluntary. And that choice must be made knowingly with awareness of certain facts. These three components have all been the subjects of development by the courts since Miranda. Burgess versus Tompkins focuses attention on the question of waiver, what the government must demonstrate to establish a relinquishment of the Miranda rights. The court notes, then explores the meaning and significance of the two other components, voluntariness and knowledge, but the crucial matter decided by Burgess is that of what constitutes proof of waiver. Here's the facts revisited. At no point did he expressly waive either his right to silence or counsel. In the Supreme Court, he raised two arguments. One, that he had invoked his right to silence by sitting silently for such a long period, and alternatively, that he did not show a waiver of his right to silence. The government did not. Court's response to the first issue is treated in the next section, meaning silence alone may or may not constitute an invocation of the right to silence, and the court closes the door on that, essentially. The excerpts from the opinion in this subsection focus on the waiver question. In other words, we look at this case, Burgess, in this subchapter and in the next. In the course of finding that a waiver had been shown, the majority minimized what the government must show to establish a Miranda waiver. After Burgess, it seems seriously misleading, if not grossly inaccurate, to suggest that the government has a heavy burden of proof. Question in the case was not whether the defendant acted knowingly or voluntarily. There was substantial evidence of the fact that he was informed enough to have been found to be knowing, and that he acted voluntarily. The court therefore focused on what the government must show to establish that a waiver occurred. Okay. The court referred in answering that question to a prior case, North Carolina versus Butler. The court concluded that express waiver, either written or oral, would be nice, but it's not necessary. Waiver may be inferred from the circumstances, from a suspect's words and actions. So, Butler was a very important predecessor decision as a stepping stone to Burgess. According to Butler, silence coupled with an understanding of one's rights and a course of conduct indicating waiver can furnish the foundation for such an inference. So, what was the course of conduct indicating waiver in Burgess? It was the defendant responding to the question about believing in God and giving prayer. That was a course of conduct the court felt was sufficient. A mere uncoerced statement is insufficient without a demonstration that the suspect understood his rights that were being surrendered. To this point in the opinion, the majority seemed to be adhering to established doctrine. The recognition in Butler that waivers can be implied generated a degree of uncertainty about how much and what kinds of evidence would be required, and again, focusing on the course of conduct, the Tompkins, I think it's proper to refer to this as Burgess, because I think Burgess was the name of the suspect. So, the Burgess majority concluded that if a suspect understands his rights, an uncoerced statement establishes an implied waiver, and presumably that it applies to both silence and the right to counsel. In general, the law can presume that an individual who, with a full understanding of his or her rights, acts in a manner inconsistent with their exercise has made a deliberate choice to relinquish the protection of those rights that those rights afford. So, you know, 2 hours and 45 minutes of silence, effective silence, one response which was incriminating, was sufficient evidence to support a finding of a waiver. Simply, a suspect who has received and understood his Miranda warnings and has not invoked Miranda rights waives the right to remain silent by making an uncoerced statement to the police. Another way of saying it, if a suspect possesses the requisite knowledge and is not coerced into speaking, his statement alone provides an adequate basis for concluding that he chose to give up the rights Miranda extends to him. Thus, Tompkins, Burgess's answer to the detective's question was a course of conduct indicating waiver on his part. The court had highlighted that a mere uncoerced answer is inadequate without proof of understanding. Does that mean that a police officer must ascertain whether a suspect does in fact understand what he is relinquishing? must there be an overt expression of understanding or at least conduct, past or present, that demonstrates sufficient appreciation of the rights being surrendered? You know, typically, the depiction of the waiver is after the rights are read, the officer says to the suspect, "Do you understand those rights?" Only if the answer is yes, does the officer go on and say, "And do you waive those rights?" Now that would be a simple case. But certainly in the complex cases like Burgess, it doesn't provide an adequate answer. The majority apparently believes that understanding can and should be found based on the delivery of warnings and an absence of evidence that a suspect did not understand his rights. This certainly shifts the burden from the government to the defense. In finding that the Tompkins waiver was sufficiently understanding, the majority noted there was no contention that he did not understand his rights, from which it followed that he knew what he gave up when he spoke. There was more than enough evidence of his understanding because he received a written copy of the warnings, read and understood English, had the time to read the warnings, and read a fifth warning out loud. Thus, the majority seems to believe that complete warnings coupled with a capacity to understand and no indications of a lack of actual understanding provide an adequate basis for concluding that a suspect had the requisite understanding. Both a waiver and the necessary comprehension of rights can be inferred from a competent suspect's willingness to respond to questions after hearing the warnings delivered. And of course, that raises a question: should more be demanded? And the answer to that is the court clearly doesn't go that way. So Burgess stands for the proposition, the propositions that we've been looking at in these slides. The final question was whether a waiver must be obtained before officers engage in interrogation. Majority rejected that constraint as well, concluding that officers may ask questions prior to a suspect's decision to relinquish his rights. Officers may interrogate a suspect who has neither invoked nor waived his or her Miranda rights. Kind of an astonishing point, but one made nonetheless. As long as the waiver is made before or simultaneously with the provision of an uncoerced statement in response to the question, Miranda is satisfied and the answer is admissible. Wouldn't the purposes of Miranda's Fifth Amendment prophylactic framework be better served by requiring adequate evidence of a decision to forego rights prior to the additional pressures presumed to arise from interrogation? Of course, one would expect the answer to that to be yes, under the principles articulated in Miranda itself, but that isn't the same way the court went. And Justice Sotomayor, in dissent, maintains that the majority ignored the important interests Miranda safeguards and that its decision boded poorly for the fundamental principles that Miranda protects. So, Burgess is a very significant decision, constituting a deviation from the ideal that was expressed in Miranda itself. Okay. Here's some reference to, oh, this is Butler. The facts in Butler are interesting after getting Miranda warnings and the police knew that the defendant could read and had an 11th grade education, he said he understood his rights and would talk, but refused to sign the form, the waiver form, which raises a serious question about the extent of the suspect's understanding. If he doesn't know that what he says can be used against him, whether it's in writing or not, does he truly understand? The court found that it was adequate. Express waiver is not required. Waiver can be implied from those circumstances. Colorado versus Spring is very interesting because it raises the question, is a suspect entitled to know what he's going to be questioned about before the questioning? And would a waiver be negated by the police or law enforcement switching subjects? So in this case, the defendant was apprehended for firearms violation. He readily confessed to that, but the law enforcement agents were really interested in a murder that they suspected him of committing. So after he confessed to the firearms violations, they switched the topic and went into the murder, which he admitted. So the question before the court was that change in subject matter a trick that negated the waiver and consent waiver? And the court held no. A defendant is not entitled to all information useful in making a decision to waive. Language like that recurs in another case, which is Moran versus Burbein, where the law enforcement questioned him without telling him that a lawyer was trying to get in to see him and could be present if they had let the lawyer in. But he waived his rights, and he did it in writing, and then he confessed. Again, the court held waiver was valid. Police are not required to supply a suspect with a flow of information to help decide whether to waive. A similar case is Connecticut versus Barrett, where the defendant was willing to talk but refused to give a written statement. And the court held that the defendant's illogical distinction between written and oral incriminating statements did not bespeak a lack of understanding of his right. And so waiver was valid. And finally, we come back to Colorado versus Connolly, reiterating once again that the pressure for the defendant to speak has to come from law enforcement, rather than the word of God telling him to confess. That's it. Anybody have any questions? We're caught up, moving on.